morning and welcome to VOA Asia from the Voice of America. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington, along with Ira Melman. It's Tuesday, February 26th. Coming up, we'll be looking at Vietnam hosting the second Trump-Kim summit. We'll also take a look at U.S.-China trade and many more stories on today's program. U.S. President Donald Trump is heading for Hanoi, Vietnam, for his second summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, voicing the hope that he would reach an agreement on details of Kim's pledge to denuclearize his country. Trump said on Twitter that without denuclearization, impoverished North Korea would endure just more of the same. But Trump predicted Chairman Kim will make a wise decision. Late Sunday, Trump told U.S. state governors that he and Kim, quote, see eye to eye, I believe, but you'll be seeing it more and more over the next couple of days. We're going to have, I think, a very interesting 2.5 days in Vietnam, and we have a chance for the total denuclearization of an area of the world that was very dangerous, unquote. Trump and Kim met last June in Singapore, after which Trump declared there is no longer a nuclear threat from North Korea. But as he meets Wednesday and Thursday with Kim in Hanoi, the Vietnamese capital, there is little concrete evidence that progress has been made to set the specific terms of North Korea's promised denuclearization.
The question that remains, well, there are a lot of questions that remain, Jim, and that is, why is it Hanoi? What are they going to do when they get there? But let's delve into that first one. Bill Gallo is going to be our new sole correspondent for the Voice of America. He is in Hanoi right now. It is why that Hanoi was chosen for this get-together between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump. And apparently the main reason was that Kim Jong-un could see what has happened as far as Vietnam is concerned. And I think we have the Bill Gallo report.
Welcome to the Socialist Republic of Vietnam, a single-party communist state that these days looks pretty capitalistic. From Western fast food restaurants to fancy luxury cars, there are signs of capitalism pretty much everywhere in this communist-ruled country, which provides an interesting backdrop for the second meeting between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. This is not the same Vietnam that the U.S. fought in the 1960s and 1970s. Though there are still signs of communist control, they're virtually drowned out by a younger generation that's creating a new national identity. Vietnam opened up its economy starting in the 1980s. Now, it's one of the world's fastest growing.
From the President Trump's perspective, Vietnam represents a communist country that has gone partially capitalist, so he'll want Kim Jong-un to see the benefits of having done that.
But it's not clear whether Kim would be convinced. For three generations, the Kim family has stayed in power, in large part because it has not implemented those kind of reforms. Another problem, international sanctions.
Those sanctions will be a real break on any development North Korea can achieve until they've denuclearized enough for the United States and the UN Security Council to lift sanctions.
Still, in his meeting with Kim, Trump is likely to point to Vietnam as a model, just as he did in Singapore with this promotional video seen here on the White House Facebook page.
Two men, two leaders.
But as Trump and Kim gather in Vietnam, the big question remains, is that what Kim actually wants? Bill Gallo, VOA News, Hanoi.
One of the sticking points in the summits has been the definition of denuclearization. When asked what that definition would be, a senior Trump administration official declined to discuss those details, citing the ongoing talks. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo told CNN Sunday there is no change in U.S. economic sanctions targeting North Korea until it agrees to full, verifiable denuclearization. He disputed Trump's claim that North Korea was no longer a nuclear threat. Pompeo said the United States is happy to make security assurances for North Korea's survival as an independent state to make North Korea more like South Korea as an economic power. And he also said the United States is offering North Korea an alternative to becoming a pariah state.
We shall see what happens. As you know, we have a full slate of correspondents heading to Hanoi right now. And hopefully we'll be able to give you updates when these talks start. This coming Wednesday.
And there's much more on Facebook at VOA Asia and also our voanews.com website. We invite you, as always, to stop by our website at voanews.com, where many Asia stories are trending at this hour. Harder tasks await Trump and Kim at Second Summit. Concerns persist about Myanmar speech freedoms. Kim Jong-un impersonator deported from Vietnam ahead of summit. Turkey renews criticism of China over Uyghur minority. Vietnam vows maximum level security for Trump-Kim summit. You'll find all of these stories, expanded coverage, lots of photos and videos to go with them, on Facebook at VOA Asia, as well as our voanews.com website.
We continue now. Stock markets in China closed up more than 5% on Monday, rallying after U.S. President Donald Trump announced he was postponing new tariffs on China because of what he said were substantial progress in trade talks between the world's two largest economies. Trump did tweet on Sunday, "A very good weekend for U.S. and China," saying both sides made progress on important structural issues, including intellectual property protection, technology transfer, agriculture, services, currency, and many other issues. The U.S. president did not say how close both sides are, but he did say he will hold a summit with Chinese President Xi Jinping at his Mar-a-Lago resort to conclude an agreement. I spoke about the trade talks and the claims by President Trump with Phil Leiby, senior fellow in the global economy at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. From 2003 to 2006, Phil Leiby served as senior economist for trade for President George W. Bush's Council of Economic Advisors.
I think that I have yet to hear President Trump say that the negotiations are really troubled and he's worried about the approach he's taken and that this may all come to naught. I think he says that things are going very well under pretty much all circumstances, so that's not terribly informative.
So why do you think that these talks in Washington were extended through the weekend?
I suspect that they've been making some progress on relatively minor issues, by which I mean things like market access, and maybe an agreement on currency, which is sufficiently bland that it won't cross any red lines.
What are the main issues in contention, do you think?
I think there's sort of two levels of issues. One is the very conventional, just how much can the administration get on, you know, will China promise not to manipulate its currency? Will it buy U.S. agricultural products? Will it buy energy products? Will it reform its intellectual property practices? And then there's the deeper issue, which this administration has set out, is will China fundamentally change some of its underlying practices, like the support of state-owned enterprises, the pursuit of industrial policy through China 2025? I think they have some hope on the former, very little hope on the latter. The only thing I would add is that the president's approach to these negotiations has weakened the U.S. position. It, by imposing a short deadline when you had ambitious goals, and by threatening retaliation, which is probably more damaging than the president wants to incur, damaging for the United States, he's made it so that I think he may be more anxious to reach a deal than the Chinese.
VOA Asia's Ira Melman speaking with economist Phil Leiby.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Happening now in Asia, U.S. President Donald Trump is heading to Hanoi for his second summit with Kim Jong-un amid hopes for a deal that would lead to the North Korean leader to give up his nuclear weapons. National Security Advisor John Bolton said a second summit was needed because North Korea had yet to live up to the commitments it made last June in Singapore. Make sure you stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. I don't know whether you heard the story or not, Jim, but there was a Kim Jong-un impersonator who showed up on the streets of Hanoi. He was an Australian guy who cut his hair the same way, kind of built like Kim Jong-un. And there was another guy who was trying to impersonate Donald Trump, not quite as well as the guy who was trying to impersonate Kim Jong-un. Well, the Hanoi government has thrown the Kim Jong-un guy out of the country, but Trump remains. So we'll see. We shall see what happens.
Some would say they threw maybe the wrong one out of the country.
All right, we're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. Activists and rights workers in Myanmar say the government's increased crackdown on the media, free speech, and peaceful assembly has created a climate of self-censorship and fear within the country. We have more from Steve Sanford.
Here in Yangon, lines of communication appear to be opening up as mobile phone usage increases. But the promises of an open society that helped put the National League for Democracy in power have become a distant dream for many who dare to speak out. Poet Meng Songja, who was jailed under the controversial Section 66D Act, leads AFIN, an activist group monitoring peaceful critics and journalists who have been prosecuted using repressive laws.
We can see that freedom of speech in Myanmar is getting worse now. The most obvious sign is that there are more reporters detained and imprisoned under this government.
Supporters of Aung San Suu Kyi say that constitutional amendments will be needed to ensure better protection for citizens. Former political prisoner Yu Shell, who spent 14 years behind bars following the 1988 student uprising, says the process could take some more time.
Currently, the Home Ministry is the main element which has full power to control every aspect of the country. Home Ministry is the driving force to govern and is controlled by the military.
While international development expands, rights groups like Human Rights Watch say foreign businesses should be wary.
If you're a business, it's considering investing in a country where you could go to jail for raising issues about corruption or questions about mismanagement in the local government where your investment is, you should really be thinking twice about whether or not that's a country where you should be putting your money, because that's a risky investment, and businesses should be looking at that if they aren't already doing so.
As Myanmar's 2020 election draws closer, observers are questioning whether it can be free and fair without allowing full freedom of speech and expression. Steve Sanford for VOA News, Yangon, Myanmar.
Thank you for being with us here on VOA Asia. Along with Jim Stevenson, I'm Ira Melman. There is a major story happening in South Asia. Both the United States and the Taliban are indicating that the current round of negotiations in Doha that started Monday may prove more critical than any other meeting until now. The U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan Reconciliation, Zalmay Khalilzad, called the Taliban's new negotiating team more authoritative, adding that this could indicate a significant movement. The Taliban negotiating team spokesman Suhail Shaheen told VOA his side was hoping for clear and fruitful results out of the current round. Khalilzad also met for the first time with one of the founding members of the Taliban, Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar, whom he helped get released from Pakistani custody last October to facilitate the peace talks. Last month, Baradar was appointed the head of the Taliban political office in Qatar that is leading the negotiations by the Taliban chief, Hibatullah Akhundzada, He was also given the position of Akhundzada's political advisor, indicating his importance in the group. Khalilzad thanked Pakistan for facilitating his travel to Qatar, meaning they paid for it. Monday's lunch reception in Doha, hosted by Qatar, was an introduction in which representatives of United Arab Emirates were also present, according to Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid. The real talks could start early Tuesday and were expected to last several days. The last round in early January ran for 6 days.
Well, the U.S. Special Representative Khalilzad tweeted, "Now the work begins in earnest." The agenda remained the same, two issues that both sides recognized as the core concerns in ending the 18-year conflict. Those are the withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan and ensuring that Afghan soil is not used by any terrorist group or individual for attacks. The Taliban negotiation team announced earlier this month that it has 14 members, including the younger brother, the Haqqani network chief. The network is blamed for some of the deadliest attacks on NATO forces in Afghanistan. The Afghan government has indicated it is not planning to free Anas, who is Anas Haqqani, who happens to be on death row at this time. The Taliban claims that he was a student that had no military role, but Afghan intelligence calls him a mastermind of social media propaganda for the Taliban. And many analysts think that his inclusion in the negotiating team is a way to build some pressure on the Afghan government to release him.
Now, what is in question here is, so far as we understand it, the Taliban's position was not to let the current Afghanistan government in on these talks. And the current government is saying, hey, we want in or nothing should happen. Now, this could put the United States between a rock and a hard place when it comes to next steps being taken. But so far, it does seem that there could be a little bit of movement away from the Afghanistan government.
The conflict in Afghanistan began in 2001. It has already turned into America's longest war. And many here in Washington who are close to the current administration have indicated that President Donald Trump's patience with the status quo is beginning to run thin.
Let's move off politics. Let's move off war for just a moment and head to the Academy Awards, which were on yesterday. Green Book, the heartwarming drama about the friendship between an eclectic African-American musician and his uncouth white driver during the segregation era, won 3 Academy Awards, including Best Picture. That most coveted award fit right into the night of diversity at the Oscars, as we hear more from VOA's Penelope Pulu.
This gentleman says that I'm not permitted to dine here. I'm afraid not.
How does he smile and shake their hands like that?
Because it takes courage to change people's hearts.
Green Book's Mahershala Ali, who plays Don Shirley, won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor. The film also won the Oscar for Best Original Screenplay. Actor Viggo Mortensen and Green Book filmmaker Peter Farrelly spoke to VOA about the film.
And he directed it so well that it almost looks easy. Almost looks effortless. But I've read thousands of scripts, and I've written 3, and I know how difficult it is to find the right balance between, you know, in the case of Green Book, dramatic tension, humor, but that's organic, that comes from a situation, from contrast between characters, great dialogue that's sparkling, that's intelligent, that has subtext to it, and a story that has a rhythm and a pace that is steady and just keeps improving. And underneath all of that, you have really a history lesson.
Green Book's wins were emblematic of this year's awards, which were all about diversity. Alfonso Cuarón's Roma also won 3 Oscars for Best Cinematography, Best Foreign Language Film, and Best Director. The story, told from the perspective of an indigenous Mexican housemaid, pays tribute to female domestic workers worldwide. In his acceptance speech, Cuarón thanked his 2 female stars, Marina de Tavira and Yalitza Aparicio, for being the heart of Roma. Roma might not have risen to such prominence had it not been produced by Netflix and streamed into millions of households all over the world. Online viewing platforms are exposing diverse films to the world, says George Mason University media expert Richard Craig.
The objective is hopefully that it opens up doors and opportunities for those voices that typically do not have the ability to compete and have their storylines and their content valued at the highest level.
Olivia Colman won the Oscar for Best Actress for her role as Queen Anne in the European film The Favorite by Yorgos Lanthimos. The movie is a political period drama told from the perspective of three women. Ryan Coogler's Black Panther was another three Oscar winner, garnering one for Best Achievement in Music and two in the costume field. Hannah Bichler and Ruthie Carter are the first African-Americans to receive Oscars for costume production and design, respectively. Ruth Carter told VOA that her costumes were inspired by African indigenous tribes and empowered the women in the story.
They have weaponry, they wear armor, but then we did it in a beautiful way. So the color is enhanced. The armor looks like jewelry. Their harness, as I call it, wraps the body in a certain way. They pay homage to their history. That's what I feel makes the wearer feel so empowered, because they're wearing their story.
Regina King won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress for her role as Sharon Rivers in Barry Jenkins' African-American drama, If Beale Street Could Talk. Spike Lee's Black Klansman, an unflinching look at race relations in America, won the Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay. Rami Malek won the Oscar for Best Actor for his role as Queen lead singer Freddie Mercury, as he's grappling with his sexuality and his immigrant background in Bohemian Rhapsody. Finally, the Oscar-winning animated feature Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is the first Black Spider-Man film to win an Oscar. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
Bao was the Academy Award winner for Best Animated Short Film, written and directed by Domi Shi. It's about a Chinese-Canadian mother suffering from empty nest syndrome, but she gets an unexpected second chance as a dumpling she makes comes to life as a boy. VOA Asia's Anna Cook spoke with director Domi Shi. We have an excerpt from that conversation.
Well, the inspiration for it for me was like over 4 years ago. Like, I really wanted to just create like a modern fairy tale. Like, I was really inspired by The Little Gingerbread Man and like all of these dark fairy tales that I grew up with. And I also just wanted to pay homage to my hometown of Toronto, Canada, and my family who are Chinese Canadian. And I just wanted to fill up this short film with all the things that I love, like Chinese food, dumpling making with my mom, and then just like I wanted to explore this like relationship between this overprotective parent and this child, and how the parent learns to let go of her little kid. It was very cathartic for me.
Yeah, I mean, it was all the brainchild of Domi, and I just was lucky that I was asked to produce it and help build the crew. We have a ton of women in leadership roles in our crew, and that was something that gave us a ton of pride in making this. We had a ton of support behind with Pixar and Disney, and even though it's really kind of an interesting, surprising story, we had a lot of love and support behind it, and I just feel so lucky that I got to be a part of it.
I don't know, like the short is just super personal in that it's very much heavily inspired by my own life growing up. I feel like ever since I was a kid, my mom has always treated me like her precious little dumpling, like always like, you know, protecting me, making sure I was safe, making sure I never wandered away too far. And I just wanted to just use this short as a way to kind of explore that relationship that I was so familiar with, and also just, but also see it from like a different point of view, like from the perspective of the parent instead of the child.
And how does it feel with Hollywood and people being more welcoming toward Asian concepts and Asian films?
Yeah, it's been great. Like, I didn't realize, like, it was so surprising to see how much Pixar embraced it. At first, I thought it was going to be too, like, culturally specific or too weird or too, like, shocking and dark, but those were the reasons why they chose it and why they decided to greenlight it. I think a lot of studios, you know, like, in Hollywood, but also all over the world, are realizing that there's, like, a slowly become a new definition for universal stories. I think for a long time, universal stories or like internationally appealing stories had like one look and one type of cast in them. But now I think, you know, everyone's just realizing that we're all kind of the same. Like we all have issues with our parents. We all kind of are brought together with food.
You can find more out about it at VOA Asia Facebook. You've been listening to VOA Asia. We thank our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Aiden Utku, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team. For Ira Melman, I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.